From the heart of Vermont, this podcast is brought to you by Capital City Concerts, a concert series which assembles exceptional musicians from across the globe in remarkable live performances in an intimate venue. Learn more at capitalcityconcerts.org.
Ben Armato, he was so wonderful with students, the way he approached them, his understanding. I guess that's what it is, his understanding of human nature.
My name is Karen Kevra, and you're listening to Muse Mentors, a podcast about artists and their mentors. Some people say it's not what you know, but who you know. I say it's how you know them. I thought it would be inspiring to have our first episode of the new year focusing on a musician who might just inspire you to adopt a new year's fitness resolution. But hold that thought. We'll circle back to it later in the podcast. David Dworkin is a dynamo. He was my orchestra conductor when I was a senior in high school, when I would travel every Saturday with my twin sister to the Manhattan School of Music for a really full day. We took classes in music theory, rhythm training, and solfege, and I remember singing Vivaldi's Gloria in a room full of 100 other teenage musicians. But what I most remember was the quality time that I clocked with David Dworkin. I was lucky enough to be part of a woodwind quintet that he coached, and he conducted the large student symphony orchestra, always the high point of my day. I hated leaving there when night fell. I relished every minute. I was struck by Maestro Dworkin's passion and energy, his expression, sense of humor, and athleticism. He was always urging us to listen, really listen to the sound that was all around us and to always, always produce a beautiful sound. His enthusiasm was contagious. He was, and probably will always be, my ideal of a conductor. David got off to a surprisingly late but great start his junior year in high school thanks to his first formal clarinet lessons that he took at a settlement school in Brooklyn, New York. The Williamsburg Settlement House was a community gathering place that worked really hard to bridge gaps between social classes by offering after-school instruction in the arts. The place had the kind of mission that would be showered in grant funding now, dirt-cheap lessons taught by young, eager, top-notch professional artists fresh from their conservatory training. Even so, this was in the late 1940s, back before Williamsburg became a hipster haven with its trendy cafes and colorful boutiques. It was a rough part of the city catering to those who had limited means. The Williamsburg Settlement House is where David Dworkin met his mentor, the young Metropolitan Opera Orchestra clarinetist named Ben Armato. Ben was the one who opened the door for David to that orchestra, where the two of them, student and mentor, sometimes played side by side in the great pit at the Met. David Dworkin, welcome to Muse Mentors.
It's a pleasure hearing your voice and reconnecting after many years.
I would like to talk to you a little bit about your childhood and your parents.
You got a little time. I'm going to take you back 86 years. I was very fortunate to have a very warm, loving mother and a father that I had such respect for because of his honesty, among other of his attributes and his warmth. I have a brother who is 93 now, and my sister who will be 92 in February, and I'm the baby. There was music in the home, but no one was a professional musician in any of my family. My father loved opera and would turn on the radio and had old recordings of Caruso. I learned about some music that way, but nothing formally. So we can skip the first 15 years, really, because I didn't get into my passion until I was a junior in high school. I was one of these guys that loved tennis, told jokes, and got through my classes on a wing and a prayer. After I decided, and my parents allowed me to take lessons, I went to Williamsburg, Brooklyn. You take the bus from Weehawken to the Port Authority bus terminal, and then you take two subways to Union Avenue. I'll never forget it. It's a long time ago. And I walked to the Williamsburg Settlement House. New York had a number of settlement houses which provided music lessons, art lessons, dance lessons for people who really couldn't afford it. I think my lesson was 25 cents or something. This was a magical place for me. I could smell the place. I was in heaven. All the instructors in music were young Juilliard graduates. Ben Armato had just graduated Juilliard. He was, I believe, the youngest person at the time to win the audition to become clarinetist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Morton Estrin was an unbelievable pianist. Suzanne Block, famous recorder player, but all young, vital people who had this passion for music. So I would go there, get there by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, take my hour lesson. I fell in love with the clarinet. Practicing. I was 16 years old when I graduated high school. Well, let me tell you, I took the audition for Juilliard. And on the audition panel, oh my goodness, was Daniel Bonnard, Robert McGinnis, all first desk players, either in the Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera. And I played my little thing and wound up with a scholarship studying with Daniel Bonnard. And so green, my dear, I never had ear training. I didn't know anything except that I loved music and somehow I had this facility for clarinet. Ben Armato, he did become a mentor. The first lessons, he must have heard something. He had magic. His passion and his wanting me to play as perfectly as possible, he'd never let go of an etude unless it was pretty close to perfection as far as technique is concerned. And after I left him and went to Juilliard, I continued a relationship with him. I would, of course, studied with Bonnard, and that was wonderful. But I'd always go back to him for a little pushing, and even much later on, when I was in my 40s and 50s, I had an occasion to play the Mozart Quintet. So I wanted to play it for many, you know, not only musically, as an example in life, but he was so wonderful with students, the way he approached them, his understanding, I guess that's what it is, his understanding of human nature. Unfortunately, he developed a throat cancer. Then he developed Alzheimer's. And I was there through all of that. I was with him the day he died. I didn't know that was going to happen, but I had visited him. He loved conductor size. And he hardly could talk. But when I left, I gave him a kiss on the forehead. And what did he do? He took his arms and started waving them around like a conductor, you know. And I left that afternoon, and that evening he passed. And it was very, very sad, you know. But he was a beautiful, beautiful person, and is still missed. Ben Armato, he was the one really instrumental in getting me into the Met. In 1960, I got a call from the Met to sub, to do a stage band for Un Ballo in Maschera, The Masked Ball. And that was my first job there.
Do you remember the first time you played in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and what it was like?
Oh my God. Just sitting in that pit and looking out and having these really beautiful people, so talented, world-class musicians around you, it was a dream. And I played under so many conductors. Von Karajan, I played in Valkyrie. A lot of conductors, besides Levine, which I played under many, many times. Sir Colin Davis came in to conduct Wozzeck. The first Wozzeck that I did was Carl Böhm. And Carl Böhm was a tough cookie. And that part, the stage band in Wozzeck, has, I believe it's only five instruments, which is kind of fun. It's a clarinet and a guitar and an accordion and a tuba and two violins. And it's a stage band, and it is on stage. And oh, my goodness.
I'll be back with David Dworkin in a moment.
After Juilliard, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. It wasn't easy to get jobs and all that business. I went to Columbia to get a degree in music and music education. And there I had to take some conducting courses. And then I fell in love with conducting. It was a whole other experience where I could share my musical ideas.
I think it's one thing to be a passenger on a great big ship, but it's something else to be the one who's steering that ship. So I'm always intrigued by musicians who turn to the baton and become conductors.
Yeah, it's very fulfilling. You're able to impart your passion. You know me, I'm a person that is very physical when I conduct, because I feel the music and it just flows. But to be able to shape this wonderful group in front of you, whether it's professional or student, how wonderful is that to be able to share your passion and know and not always know? That's one thing about teaching. You don't know. That's why you got to be careful what you say, because you don't know how it's affecting the ears that are listening. Hopefully in a very positive, beautiful way.
Oh, I think so. You know what? I want to tell you my first memory of you.
Uh-oh.
So I am a junior in high school, as is my twin sister. And we go into the Manhattan School of Music to audition for the preparatory program there for high school kids. And I can tell you, I felt like I had a bowling ball in my stomach waiting to audition. And I remember so vividly walking into the room. I remember what the light was like. And there were two people there. It was you and Eleanor Lawrence, who I went on
sure.
to study flute with.
Love her, right.
At that point, had quite a few auditions under my belt, and they were almost clinical, cold experiences where you would walk into a room and either be greeted by an enormous screen or a panel of judges who all had their backs turned toward you. And here you are, this high school kid, being asked to show what you can do and be expressive and put your heart on the line. And I'll never forget, I played for that audition that day, the first movement of the Mozart G major flute concerto. And you welcomed me so warmly within a minute, I felt completely comfortable and happy, and I played my best. It was really unusual. I wonder sometimes, was that the MO that you just brought to the auditions that you heard, or was that just you being you?
Yeah, I think that was me being me. I really feel that having been in the position of auditioning and knowing what it feels like. And anyhow, look, I am a positive person, and I really do believe in goodness and making people smile and be happy. It goes to the grocery clerk taking your packages and when you pay at the end and you walk up and say, "Hey, what a great day it is. You're looking super." And you get a big smile. It's so easy to do that rather than anything else.
I'll be back with David Dworkin in a moment. Capital City Concerts and Muse Mentors want to shine a light on some Montpelier, Vermont downtown businesses who have supported us for decades. Thanks to Bear Pond Books, a Montpelier institution, one of those classic New England bookstores with the wonderful creaky wooden floors and floor-to-ceiling shelves of perfectly organized books, and with an entire floor of children's books where kids have experienced the magic of reading for what's coming up on half a century. You should shop there. Bear Pond Books offers in-store pickup and backdoor pickup during store hours and website orders with shipping anywhere in the USA. So next time you think to order from an online megastore, think twice. Please support this terrific independent bookstore, bearpondbooks.com. Now well into his 80s, David Dworkin has developed a really appealing fitness program, which combines conducting, exercise, and intense music listening. He calls it Conductorcise, a sound workout for body and soul. It's a low-impact physical workout combined with music. David Dworkin is like the Jack LaLanne of classical music. And if you're wondering who the heck Jack LaLanne is, he was a fitness celebrity who came before Jane Fonda and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And now here is a man who will show you how to feel better, look better, Jack LaLanne.
My name is Jack LaLanne, and I'm here for one reason and one reason only, to show you how to feel better and look better so you can live longer. Please keep your dial right where it is.
David Dworkin has presented his interactive programs to groups of all ages. And in the case of seniors, it's been shown to be effective for treating Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. He's gotten lots of accolades too, and some great recognition, including an Innovation Award from the International Council on Active Aging.
I always thought that conducting was a very physical work. What I've learned since the business about releasing endorphins, just the same as when you go out for a run in the morning or anything else, exercise, and dopamine and cortisol levels, which are markers for depression, go away. And that's why you're high after a concert. At least I am, and I'm not on anything. I don't go to sleep because I'm so active after a concert. I'm never tired. And so I said, why don't we try something that'll get people moving easily? Stick a baton in their hand or a chopstick in their hand or something and move the way a conductor moves. Show them a few patterns. If they do the patterns, fine. If they don't do the patterns, fine. And I started this way and it seemed to catch on. Then in 2008, which was a turning point, there's an organization called the International Council on Active Aging, ICAA. And I submitted a proposal to do a presentation there. The kinds of people that attend these conferences are staff members from retirement communities, but they go from independent through memory care. I've done it for 25 people. I've done it for 500 people. The normal thing is 75 or 50 of independents come into a room, and I have all my music on my laptop, and I have my mic on, and I pass out chopsticks. I say the only difference between my baton and your chopstick is $26.36. And I keep it light. There's got to be a lot of humor and fun and energy and moving. And you'd be surprised. We do all kinds of music from Strauss waltzes to the Beethoven Fifth to you name it.
Stars and Stripes Forever.
Yeah. Oh, Stars and Stripes. All the Sousa marches and circus marches. The Brahms Hungarian dances, the Slavonic dances, the Moldau. I've done a lot. And they enjoy it so much because they forget their problems of the moment. And I tell them, problems don't go away. What I've learned from wonderful people, psychiatrists, psychologists, people working in the area of aging, a number of physicians. One is a Dr. John Ratey, who is on the faculty of Harvard Med School. And he wrote a wonderful book called Spark. And that's the revolution of exercise in the brain, what it does to move. It's just amazing. And then there's also the brain that changes itself. It's called neuroplasticity. But I'm learning about what goes on in your head when you listen to music. And that's the other thing, listening to music, really listening, not just the melody. Listen to the conversations, listen to the left hand on the piano or the bass in the orchestra, a counter melody. Oh my goodness. And they actually say, you know, I never heard that before, but now I hear.
One of the exciting things about being a musician these days is the interaction of science and music. And you mentioned the book by your colleague, John Ratey.
Right.
Yeah. And it got me thinking about a really inspiring book that I've read a number of times and have recommended and do recommend to my students, written by a guy named Daniel Coyle, called The Talent Code. Wow. Do you know this book?
No, I don't. I'll write it down.
It's about the neural insulator. It's this coating that wraps around our nerves called myelin.
Right.
And neurologists consider this to be the kind of the holy grail of acquiring skill. And I remember my teacher used to say to me, practice something, do your repetitions, do them slowly, do them thoughtfully.
Right.
And then leave it. And it will work on you while you sleep. It turns out he was absolutely right. There is this physical manifestation of talent that happens. And this is actually what we would consider to be the building of muscle memory. But it's so exciting and empowering to know about these things, similar to what you're talking about in the work that you've been researching.
Absolutely. You know, there's a place in the city called the Institute of Music and Neurologic Function. And you talk about neurologist Oliver Sacks. You know
yes,
the name?
Yes, of course.
Well, he worked there. And what they do there is just amazing. When you exercise, you are creating brain cells. When you're listening to music, that's enhancing it all. And he used to take photos of your brain, which would look like a pinball machine lighting up the reds and the blues, because wiring is being connected. And it's just another world of knowledge that I can know a little bit about and share it when I do the conductor size program, because people like to know a little bit about what's happening to them while they're doing this. But it's more than physical. I tell stories about the composers, about the time period, about the music, and this all stimulates the brain as well. And that's what's so important.
One of the things that struck me about some of the videos that I saw of your conductor size events with large groups of people was the smiles on their faces.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you see people smiling at concerts in the audience when they're sitting down, but when people are moving to the music in the way that they do when they're doing conductor size, there's something happening at another level. And it gets me thinking about how I remember when I started high school and became part of my really excellent high school marching band. It all came together for me, I think, as a musician, because I had to move to the music. I was feeling the music in my body, and something incredibly tactile went on.
Exactly.
And I see that happening in these videos from conductor size.
I mean, I can tell you stories about people who walk in with a very sad face and they walk out smiling and moving. And I tell them it's not the wonder drug, although I do think it's the best prescription for any level of health and age. But so it will last X amount of time for some people the rest of the afternoon, or they'll carry it through. But while they're doing it, and that's the thing, they focus in on what we're doing. They forget about their dear friend who just had to be put into the memory care section and now they can't see them every day. It's unbelievable things are happening with Parkinson's disease and music.
Yes.
And Baroque music. You know, Vivaldi, Bach, because it is so rhythmically strict and it helps connect the wiring. It's in disease, there's something called freezing, where a person just can't walk. They need some kind of motivation to get them going. Well, they put an iPod or something in their ear for this music, and again, a Baroque music that's very rhythmically strict. And you know, not in hours, in minutes, they start walking normally because there's a connection there. So they're working on all of this. And of course, music is the last thing that goes in memory. That's documented.
That's right. I have a quote that I wanted to read to you that I have a feeling you're familiar with. Maybe you can identify who said this, and if not, I'll tell you. But in any case, I'd like you to respond to it. Here's the quote. In order for man to succeed in life, God provided him with two means, education and physical activity, not separately, one for the soul and the other for the body, but for the two together. With these two means, man can attain perfection.
Wow, that's beautiful. No, I don't know. Who?
Well, that was Plato.
Oh, well, Plato. My favorite, Plato. Music is a moral law. It gives soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, a charm to sadness, gaiety and life to everything. It is the essence of order and lends to all that is good and just and beautiful. And that's Mr. Plato, who lived between 400 and 300 BC.
If you've enjoyed the Muse Mentors podcast, please support us through a Patreon subscription in any amount or through a one-time donation at musementors.com. Until next time, try moving, really moving, to some music that you love.